Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
You know, if you think about Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, these entrepreneurs were dissidents. That is, they stood up to a system that existed and basically told them, no, they're wrong, and that they didn't care what the state or the system said. They were going to do something very different. And that's the part where China's on the wrong side of history.
From South China Morning Post, this is Inside China Tech. Insights into what matters.
Come work for us because we are 996.
Are you okay?
大家好，我是洛天依。
I started Alibaba 1999 in my apartment.
不死给华为.
Speed and data, and that's where China comes in.
Here are your hosts, Zhen Su and Chua Kong Ho.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the first episode of the relaunched Inside China Tech. I am Zhen Su, a technology reporter at the South China Morning Post.
And I'm Kong Ho, the technology editor.
As some of you might have heard from the trailer, this is a tale of two countries in innovation, China and the US. So the common stereotype that we have of US innovation, or, you know, in Silicon Valley as the tech powerhouse of the world, is that innovation is often bottom-up and driven by free market forces, whereas in China, it is state-led and therefore top-down.
So today on the show, we ask ourselves, is there a formula for success? Can China ever hope to compete?
We were quite surprised to see that the US model and how China had its beginnings in technology are actually much more similar than we think.
So, where do we start?
Of course, war.
The history of Silicon Valley was actually as a defense ecosystem in the middle of what we in the United States call the Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union.
This is Steve Blank.
I'm an adjunct professor at Stanford University and a senior fellow at Columbia University in New York.
So in the 1950s, the US and the Soviet Union, then two large superpowers, were in an intense rivalry in every dimension: politics, economy, propaganda, and essentially military power.
All US universities, research universities, were helping build weapon systems for our military. And Stanford University's expertise was in microwaves and electronics.
Now, there was a professor at Stanford who was critical to Silicon Valley's formation. His name was Frederick Emmons Terman. He was teaching electronics at the time.
When I started teaching, I was teaching a variety of things, but no one was offering a course in what today we call electronics, but which then we called radio engineering. And so I thought one ought to be started.
Fred Terman did something unique that no other professor in any other of those research universities ever did. And that is, he pointed his students and professors outward and said, take your inventions and go start companies, because that will actually help the country more than a few professors. And so Stanford University participated in military research, but became kind of an entrepreneurial cluster or center for innovation in the United States.
Terman invited another very critical figure to our story, William Shockley, a Nobel Prize winner and a co-inventor of the transistor.
Well, the war intervened, and during that time I went out of physics and worked on problems of military operations, what is now called operations research.
He came to Palo Alto and started the first semiconductor company in California called Shockley Semiconductor.
And about 15 months later, eight of his best and the brightest people left, because it turns out Shockley was the world's best recruiter and technologist, and probably one of the worst bosses that ever existed in Silicon Valley. And so his eight best engineers left to start a company called Fairchild Semiconductor.
And in fact, you can trace the history of all chip businesses back to these first two companies, Shockley and Fairchild.
While we couldn't beat the Soviet Union with tanks and artillery and planes that they were building up in Central Europe, we can actually beat them with semiconductor factories and software.
And people who started Fairchild and worked at Fairchild actually went on to create other tech businesses such as Intel, AMD, you know, and even Kleiner Perkins, the very famous venture capital firm that we know today.
So what you're telling me is that the US is great at semiconductors today, and that basically boils down to one bad boss?
Yeah, I guess you can say that.
But these are universities and private companies that you're talking about. Sure, they were operating in a Cold War context, but, you know, what's the government's role in all of this?
So it turns out that the military in the 1950s and 60s was the largest customer for all of these electronic companies in the valley. After the Soviet Union launched its first space satellite, Sputnik, in 1957.
Sputnik and Mutnik, they were called. Man's greatest technical achievement, only a crude prototype of the true spaceship of the future.
The US was afraid that they were lagging behind technologically. And the US government, under President Eisenhower, turned to fund Fairchild, the only company in the world that was able to make transistors at the time.
So the first batch of semiconductors was actually sold to the military to make bombers or to be components in the B-70 bomber.
This is Andy Mock, a senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization.
Silicon Valley, really actually the roots of it were very directly tied to the government. And we see this with China as well.
If we roll it back just a little bit, about 50 years ago in China's modern history, all industries were nationalized and there was basically no private sector. Everything in China was owned by the state.
Well, if you think about it, let's just kind of roll in all the pieces that China did is that, you know, in the 80s, there were R&D institutes and universities, and then Chinese banks started playing and, you know, the local technology zones. And, you know, in the mid 90s, Chinese venture capital funds. And then in like 2001, foreign VC firms were let in. In 2004, there was an IPO market in China, and then government venture funds, and then eventually Chinese angel funds. And, you know, there was the key technology R&D program. In 1986, there was the 863 program, 98, the 973 program, and then 98.
The Wait, hey, what are those numbers?
The thing about the Chinese is that they like to use numbers as shorthand, you know, like to make the program titles shorter. So the 863 program is actually China's state high-tech development plan. And the reason it's called 863 is because it was implemented in 1986 and in March. So 86 and 3. So yeah, at that point of time, many of China's different programs were characterized by numbers, basically.
But all these are now kind of background to Chinese commercial ventures. But remember, the goal for the government was all this commercial stuff is an accident.
So it does look like China has a kind of a similar start to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, so they both had their beginnings in government money. So, you know, like in the Cold War, the government then wanted to enlist the efforts of the universities. And as we've just heard, China also did it the same way.
But there must be some differences, right?
Hello?
Hello, hi, is this Professor Zhou? Hello.
Yeah, this is her.
Hi, okay. Hello, hi, this is Zen from the South China.
So
Morning
I spoke
Post.
To Professor Yu Zhou.
I'm a professor at Vassar College. I specialize in economic geography. I have been doing research on China high-tech industry.
She also told us that it's simply not true that the United States had all of this innovation because it was driven by the free market.
We had the Manhattan Project, we had Star Wars, we had the internet highways. All these are state investment, all of which helped the Silicon Valley to develop their new technology.
But it is also inaccurate and misleading to characterize China's innovation as entirely top-down.
I would say, yes, China has a top-down system. But our research have shown China actually have a dual-track system. So it has a very strong state-led innovation, but it's also have very powerful market-driven innovation.
So what are some examples of, you know, China showing kind of like bottom-up sort of market-driven kind of innovation?
The entire internet industry, for example, many of the internet apps and address many of the daily life, these are not planned by the Chinese government. The cell phone industry, Chinese government actually in the early 2000s were still trying to license only limited cell phone company to a few company they find reliable, but many company emerged that what we call the Shanghai, you know, knockoff and so on in the early 2000s, and some of them became eventually consolidated in the 3G era, became the major company like Xiaomi and so on. Xiaomi is not a state company, for example, and many of the internet company, almost none of them are. So none of this was planned by the Chinese government or even anticipated by the Chinese government. So we have to say China's innovation is both top-down and bottom-up.
So is it necessarily a bad thing or a good thing?
Just like with everything else, China's model has its pros and cons.
China has been a lot more hands-on, sometimes for good, most times not particularly that great, you know, to say, okay, we should have this and that. But it is also easier for China because it doesn't stand on the frontier of technology, so it can see in the world what works, what doesn't. Say, you know, renewable energy, we should push for it because it is important. We can see it is important. United States somewhat on the frontier, there's no one out there to prove to us what work, what doesn't. So it is harder for the United States to say that's what we're going to do.
So China lagging behind actually gave it certain advantages. And right now, you know, China is still catching up in many sectors. It's not on a par with the US yet, but the speed is very impressive.
And that very speed is raising concerns in the US, where many are worried that we are seeing the beginnings of a tech cold war.
Squawk Box, a new report this morning saying that China used tiny chips in a hack that infiltrated US businesses, including Amazon and Apple.
The administration is considering a crackdown on Chinese investments in U.S. technologies by using a law reserved for national emergencies.
I can take care of China in my back pocket.
And God bless America. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
I think, first of all, I hope they're not locked in to a technology war. Maybe they are, but hopefully certain solution can emerge. In this type of information technology industry, the world is mostly integrated. Say, United States design semiconductor chips. Taiwan firms manufacture into foundries. In between, many, many designers are designing different chips. And then these chips would then be used in cell phones and things like that. So each of the services is built on top of each other. The United States provides the basic infrastructure for these software and hardware. Well, you can say, well, why can China do it? Yes, China can if it put in energy. But before it actually, there's no commercial reason to do so, because United States chips are better and cheaper, right? Is that mean there is no alternative? Of course there are alternative, but there is no reason to use these alternatives.
Okay, so basically right now, if they don't come to a kind of resolution, everyone will suffer and China will just simply...
everyone would have to find their own way, right?
Yeah.
Everyone would have to make a decision. All of these decisions will cost money. But the point is, once you develop a different platform, it is extremely difficult to go back. So once you stop selling chips to China, you can't, in the future, sell chips to China.
Okay, so what we found out so far is that the US is not purely bottom-up when it comes to technology innovation, so they had a lot of help from the US government in terms of federal and military funding. We also realized that for China, it is not purely state-led and top-down. Finally, and this is news to nobody, but if there was an actual tech cold war, it's going to hurt everyone, you know, not just the US and China, but the rest of the world as well.
Sure, everyone loses, and China looks as if it's going to hurt quite badly. but it does have a card in its pocket.
So one of the huge advantages China has, which I'm not sure most Americans understand, is that it's a domestic market.
That's Steve Blank again.
China probably equals the entire world. You know, the U.S. thinks it has a large domestic market of a couple hundred people, but China has a market 5 to 6 times the size of that. And so one of the things that makes Chinese entrepreneurs kind of independent is not only did the Great Firewall force them to face inward, but the marketplace inward is large enough to build multiple unicorns and billions of dollars in sales without ever having to worry about the outside world. Whereas that's not true in almost any other country, even the United States.
As the English saying goes, necessity is the mother of invention. So that really got us thinking, if China is so powerful and innovative, where is the limit? Why hasn't China been able to produce another true tech visionary like Steve Jobs?
You know, the bounding box is not, at least in my belief, not going to be whether the trade war crimps China's ability to kind of acquire. It's whether the culture of a state command and control system will allow innovation to flourish in that kind of environment. And that's the part where China's on the wrong side of history. You know, if you think about Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, you know, the Facebook people, Google guys, everything we think of as innovation in the United States, these entrepreneurs were dissidents. That is, they stood up to a system that existed and basically told them, no, they're wrong. And that they didn't care what the state or the system said. They were going to do something very different. And please don't take it as I don't think the Chinese could innovate. Of course they can. They've done a great job. It's just that how much can you innovate inside of a well-padded prison?
So the idea here, I guess the claim is that a certain kind of political freedom promotes technological innovation.
Remember Andy Mock?
And the related idea to that is not having a certain kind of political freedom inhibits technological innovation. I would say not at all. I think one thing is that has made Silicon Valley work, certainly after the foundation of the government being the catalyst for starting it, but what has kept it going was being a magnet for the best and brightest technical talent all around the world. What was another catalyst was winning World War II and being able to quote-unquote liberate a lot of German technology. And of course that technology that was developed in the 30s under Nazi Germany was not an open society. Look at the Soviet Union as well. So while economically they did not do well, but were very competitive technologically during the Soviet era. So I think there are good examples where countries have been able to innovate without the American-style political system or political freedom. The U.S. in some ways was a country that was born on third base, but thinks it hit a triple. It did something really great, but in some important ways, it was just lucky.
So I'm just curious, it seems like, say, no other country has produced another Bill Gates or another Steve Jobs, you know, and I'm just curious as to why you think that is. And for example, would you say like entrepreneurs in China, say Pony Ma or Ren Zhengfei or Jack Ma, like are they on the same level? Would you compare them to the same level? Yes or no? And, you know, and why?
I think they are on the same level. The reason the U.S. produced so many names is because the Americans are really good at telling individual stories.
When you say story, what do you mean by story?
Well, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs are clearly heads of very successful companies, but by personalizing them as representing the success of the companies, we also ignored a lot of other important contributors. So the reason I say story is the narrative about how Bill Gates become successful. Oh, he dropped out of Harvard. And then he put his mind together. He developed that software companies. That's a very simple story. Mm. And the reality is much more complicated than that. Steve Jobs, same thing. We talk about his taste, his genius, and his design, right? But his idea did not only come from his own head. He was in Silicon Valley. He got idea from many other people. We don't tell that part of the story.
I see.
Yeah, you know, when we talk about something, we talk about this person. It's easily relatable, but it's simplified. Ren Zhengfei clearly is very important for Huawei. Jack Ma is important for Alibaba. But are they the full story? They're not, right?
I just wanted to maybe just challenge some of the points that you've just said, in a sense that Apple was based on pre-existing technology, and of course, like, you know, he tends to be the face of the company, and it wasn't that he started that all by himself. But if you look at, say Jack Ma, even, like, Jack Ma himself also is often the face of the company, right? Like,
yeah,
like people credit him with, like, I mean, I guess in China his fame is also maybe, you know, similar to, everyone knows who Jack Ma is, everyone knows who Steve mm-hmm. Jobs is. Mm-hmm. But even for Alibaba, the idea of, like, e-commerce,
yeah,
is come not is also elsewhere. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I'm just
right.
Yeah.
No, I'm saying, like, all of these stories, when it's centered on the individual, it became simplified. So it ignores a lot of other contributors. So this is why I do not think innovation is basically driven by individualism. To some degree, it is important to have individualism, but it is not the primary driver. Every country, even in China, there are a certain degree of individualism. United States has more, but is that the most critical driver for innovation? I'm not sure it is.
What is the most critical factor to you, you think?
You have to have a market. Anything you make, it has to be able to sell it, right? However, the state does play a role in terms of providing infrastructure. A state has to be willing to invest in education of its population, for researchers, for technicians, and for common workers. This is why China has better development and innovating conditions than many other developing countries. Because China has the income growth provide the market, the state investment in education provides workers, generally educated workers, technicians, researchers, and returnees from abroad, right? Returnees will only return when their knowledge can be useful and when they can get reward by investing startup companies and their knowledge can work.
Okay, so maybe individualism is not a critical factor for innovation, but I'd still say that Silicon Valley seems to have a different take on failure. So Eric Ries, who is the author of the book The Lean Startup, he told us that when he was a failed entrepreneur trying to look for jobs.
And in a lot of places around the country, when I was applying for jobs, people saw that as a negative. They said, well, you know, I had failed at my previous job. I must not be very good. But nobody in Silicon Valley saw it that way. Like, people here were very excited. Development, it was a sign that I had shown initiative, that I had tried to do something new. And the fact that I had failed was not very surprising because most startups fail. So I remember one startup that I was interviewing with, they were thrilled. They said, this is great. Somebody else paid for your education in failure. We don't have to pay for it.
Basically, they viewed failure as experience.
Exactly.
So Zen, after talking to all of these people, what are some of the biggest takeaways for you?
So when I first started researching this story, you know, for this podcast, I was fully expecting people to give me, you know, really stereotypical answers like that the West was really driven by free market forces and the fact that individualism is a really important part of their culture. Because that was my impression of Silicon Valley, right? Like I thought that it was just a bunch of really innovative people who all congregated in one place and managed to create all of these amazing tech companies. So it was really surprising to see that a lot of it actually originated from government funding and that the state has actually an important part to play in terms of building infrastructure and laying the groundwork for companies to innovate and build upon. So similarly, in China, I started off with the impression that China was very much a top-down sort of innovation system because, you know, the government plans for all these things. They have state subsidies, they have grants, they have five-year plans, they have stuff like Made in China 2025. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely refreshing to hear that the government also only has a limited part to play. At the end of the day, it really depends on the product that you're creating, whether or not there's a market for it, whether or not people want it. Because no matter what you do, even if the government, you know, like Professor Zhou said, even if the government tried to force something to happen, but if nobody wants it, there's no way you can get that off the ground.
Well said.
I'm so amazing.
That's great. I really learned something today. And that's what we really want to do with the podcast. To go beyond just the stereotypes, to dig deeper and to bring you insights into the most important trends in China technology. We have more great content coming your way. We have the China Internet Report, which is a very comprehensive look into the China tech landscape coming up on the 10th of July, where we will unpack a lot of the latest trends, the hottest companies, and everything that you need to know about China tech.
So earlier we mentioned Alibaba and Jack Ma, so as a disclaimer, Alibaba is the parent company of the South China Morning Post. This episode was produced and edited by Yang Yang. We'd like to thank Steve Blank, Eric Rees, Andy Mok, and Yu Zhou, as well as our intern, King Wu. If you like this first episode of our revamped Inside China Tech podcast, tell us on Twitter. We can be found with the handles at Zensu, that's at Z-E-N-S-O-O, and
at Chua Kong Ho, that's C-H-U-A-K-O-N-G-H-O. We also have a Facebook group called Inside China Tech. Just search ICT on Facebook and we will pull you in.
You have to search Inside China Tech, not ICT. We are a fortnightly podcast and new episodes drop every 2 weeks, where we hope to bring you insights into what matters in China's tech development. Anyways, good to be back. Very happy to be hosting this podcast again after our long hiatus. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Are we done?
No.
Are we done? Are we still recording? I gotta run.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.